Me neither. Smells familiar. Smells bad. Kind of a potent mix of sweaty socks and pain-relieving ointment. This is the type of locker room where I spent a huge chunk of my life pitching for teams like the Pittsburgh Crawfords and the Birmingham Black Barons. Most definitely not a major league clubhouse, no. This is the type of locker room we used in the Negro baseball leagues. That's where us colored ball players practiced our art form way back before the turn of the 20th century and right up until the 1950s. Yep, Satchel Paige, that's me. And all the rest of us. So-called major leagues, even though much of the American baseball talent was on our rosters. I played with some of the greatest players of the day, maybe the greatest ever, and I definitely pitched to the best hitter of them all, catcher Josh Gibson. Josh could out-homer and out-drink Babe Ruth. My teammates included my good buddy, Buck O'Neill at first base, Hank Thompson at third, and over the last few years, a young kid named Jackie Robinson playing between them. Then one day, I'm sitting in a stinky little locker room just like this, and somebody comes running in with the news. Mr. Branch Rickey of the Brooklyn Dodgers just signed up Jackie Robinson. You mean to tell me that that kid is gonna be the first colored ball player in the major leagues? More than 20 years after my first trouble ball, Jim Crow got busted on the nose and I wasn't even there to throw the first punch. I was the one that started all that talk about letting us in the big time. I was the one that opened up the major league parks to the colored teams. I was the one the famous white ball players wanted to go barnstorming against. And Jackie didn't care nothing about being an entertainer or being famous. Me, I just had to be famous. Yeah, Jackie's good, but he's no Leroy Satchel Paige. Leroy Paige. That's the name my mama gave me on July 7th, Mobile, Alabama. The year? Well, that all depends on who you believe. It was either 1905, 1906, or 1911, depending on whether my mama was odd enough, my age or not. As mama says, that's not important. What's the age of Satchel Paige? Now, I never understood what the big deal was. When I tell people my real age, they just don't believe me anyhow. If somebody would ask, I'd just say, well, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you was? Now, you might also ask about my nickname. Well, I was a big kid. Big kids got big feet. So they started calling me Satchel Foot. That's because when I came around the corner, first you saw my satchels, then you saw me. No. My feet ain't got nothing to do with my nickname. But you hear all sorts of other stories about how I came to be called Satchel. I'm sure there's one true story out there somewhere. Now, my life, my baseball life, that started when I was about 13. I played some already, but that was the real start. Now, in this one game, we was getting beat pretty bad when somebody remembered that I threw pretty hard and they sent me in to pitch. Well, I was already tall, but I only weighed about 100 pounds. I looked like four rubber bands glued together. The other team was laughing, but I could throw hard all right. And the first two batters crowded the plate, so I threw the ball right at them, hit both of them. Poof! Poof! After that, they all got scared because I was so fast and they thought I had no control. They all refused to bat, and we won the game by a forfeit. Of course, I did have control. I could always throw the ball right where I wanted to. It was a natural gift I had even as a little kid. One thing sure, I could throw. Always I could throw. And we had gang fights there in Mobile. South side against north side, but not as vicious as today because we didn't use knives and guns, we used rocks. Our south side gang won a good share of those fights, and I could always hit the side of somebody's head every time I threw. I used to steal things too. Snatch him and run. One time, I stole a rich guy's satchel right from under his arm. That's how I got my nickname. Another time, I stole some rings from a jewelry store and ran. But the store guard, he had longer legs than me, and he chased me down Commerce Street and caught up to me. I put the rings in my mouth, and when he hit me, the rings flew out. The police sent me to reform school. If I'd have been 18, they'd have sent me to jail. So sometimes, not knowing your exact birth year has some benefits. What's reform school like? 5 a.m., line up, get breakfast, go to class, then go out in the field to cut timber, pull potatoes, pick cotton. That was sunrise to sundown. Then at night they locked you in, but it wasn't all bad. You put in a hard day's work, but you got a full stomach for it. And when you grow up as poor as me, even a place like that can be pretty warm and good. And only two kids to a bed, that was even better than home. But reform school was important for another reason. I got to play on the baseball team. We had a coach named Mr. Bird. Luckily for me, he was the baseball coach, and he told me I was gonna be the pitcher. Well, by now, I was over 6 feet tall, and he told me to kick my front foot way up in the air so it looked like I was kicking the sun. So I started striking out everybody, and teams started noticing. When I got out of reform school, I started pitching for whatever team wanted me, and they all did. On my first overnight trip, I asked the bus driver to take us wherever we were staying. That's where you're staying, Satch. And he pointed to a field. We were treated like favorites, not ball players. It was the first time I realized that even baseball, the sport that I love, the game that got me out of reform school, was just as segregated as an Alabama restaurant. When I was about 17, a fellow came out of the stands and approached me. He asked if I threw that fast consistently. I said, no, sir, I do it all the time. He says, I want you to pitch for the Chattanooga Black Lookouts in the Negro Leagues. I said, you'll have to ask my mama. Now, mama, she didn't like baseball, never saw me pitch, and couldn't understand why somebody would be paid to do it. She thought it was sinning, always playing and never working. But this fellow offered to send the money to her directly. She agreed. $450 a month, $400 a month, and $50 to me.
Oh,
in Chattanooga, I was throwing the ball so hard, even my catcher couldn't see it. One catcher said it was like trying to stop a freight train with the brakes going bad. But I was learning to control my pitches. And my pitching philosophy is simple. Just throw the ball where you want to. Home plate, don't move. So I sometimes use my jump ball, my trouble ball, my long ball. I got a hiccup pitch, a humdinger, a holy moly. I also got a steer ride. You reach the plate before the K. And of course, I got my page turner. That's P-A-I-G-E. You should have seen me when I warmed up. Home plate was too big for me. So I sometimes use a small little matchbox or a piece of cigarette paper and put it in front of the catcher instead. I figure if I could throw over a small target like that, I sure would get it over a great big plate. One player said I could hit a mosquito flying over the corner of the plate. That's what he said, not me. Now sometimes I'd rile up the crowd just for fun. I'd stomp around the mound kicking dirt. And when the boom would start, I'd holler, okay, someone's gonna have to pay for that. And I'd strike out the sod. Sometimes on only 9 pitches. A couple of times, I felt so good. I told all my outfielders and all my infielders to take off their gloves, sit down in the field, because I was gonna mow down the batters all by myself. And I did. Best hitter of them all. The catcher, Josh Gibson, he respected my abilities and I respected his. We would purposely set up situations where we were one-on-one for the big prize. So one time I got this crazy idea. There's one man on base, and I was going to intentionally walk the next 2 batters and then pitch to old Josh with the bases loaded. Mano a mano, winner take all. Well, I walked the first batter on 4 pitches. By the time I threw the second ball to the next batter, everybody in the stadium knows what's happening. So I said, okay, Josh, now I'm gonna throw you some fastballs. And Josh says, show me what you got. Before I wound up to throw the first pitch, I said, all right, now I'm going to throw you a taste at your waist. And boom, strike one. I got the ball back. I said, and now I'm going to throw you one a little better at your lettuce. And bam, strike two. Crowd standing on their feet and they're going crazy. I said, okay, Josh, I got you 0-2. And in this league, I'm supposed to knock you down. But I'm not going to throw smoke at your yolk. I'm going to throw a pee at your knee. And boom, strike three. Headlines, next day, said Satch fans Josh Gibson with three on base. Didn't even say he won the game. That's what people came to see. But it wasn't a game that beat up our bodies. It was a traveling and hard living that took a toll. Once we were on the road, there weren't many hotels that would allow colored folks to register. So we stayed in second-class lodges and ate at third-class restaurants, if they even let us in. If not, a porter would sneak food to us through a back entrance. Through it all, we often earned less than $100 a game for the whole team. Negro baseball truly mirrored America at the time. We was the best in the world, but we was treated like the worst. But we all knew we had to hold our tongues. Nights can be downright scary in some cities. And God bless the man who might get caught looking at a white woman. Lynching and burning, they're still common in the 30s and 40s. Some of these places, crowds formed to watch the spectacle, and they brought their little kids along to see, as if it was some sort of theater production. People that did these things, they posed for pictures with the dead bodies and then sent them out as postcards. Baseball allowed me to hide my anger inside me. But I had some other diversions. Now sometimes I hear, hey Satch, we see that you leave a ticket at the box office for your wife, but every day a different woman picks it up. Now, some of the stories about my womanizing may not even be true, or else I just forgot stuff ever happened. But eventually my high living started to catch up with me. By this time I was 35 or something, but not important. But one night I woke up with more pain in my arm than any man should have to endure. To ease the strain on my arm, I threw only jump balls. I pitched from every angle. I threw overhand, crossfire, underhand. The hitters kept waiting for me to uncork my fastball, but I couldn't and wouldn't throw it. Now finally, in the seventh inning, the coach orders me to uncork my fastball. Oh, God! What do you mean I'll never pitch again? Doc, this is what I do. My arm is my life. Well, my arm is gone, shot dead. I thought some of the owners would be willing to pay me to be on their teams, to manage or help attract the crowd into the grandstand, but now nobody wants me around anymore. The word's gotten around that I can't even throw. I really thought they'd be glad to have Satch around, ready to entertain. Now, it tore at me daily that I wasn't allowed in the major leagues, but that's the rules we all have to face. It's a much more deeper hurt, somewhere back behind your heart, wrapped around your soul, when your dignity as a man is at stake. And now this injury, that's like a double hurt. And now my own sport has turned its back on me. Now, when you've been at the top and hit the bottom, it's a mighty long fall. Only one ball club owner was even willing to talk to me after my arm was dead, Mr. J. L. Wilkinson of the Monarchs. Now, Mr. Wilkinson, he's a heck of a guy. He made sure we was always working, even when most of the country wasn't. Well, I can't lie to a man like that. I says, hey, Mr. Wilkinson, my arm's just not good anymore. He's willing to give me a chance with a bunch of washed-up Monarchs, and he says he can use me as a gate attraction under the name Satchel Paige All-Star. So now I have me a piece of work. I'd been dead, but now I was alive again. But I didn't do no throwing at all, not even a couple of feet. And I was so disgusted, I didn't even play catch with the boys, because nobody was going to see a shadow of the old satch. And one hot day, we're playing an exhibition game. I'm standing in the first base coaching box when the ball comes rolling toward me from the bullpen. And I'm thinking, I picked it up, drove back. About 2 minutes later, my brain says, how'd that ball get back in the bullpen? I throwed it, I answered. Maybe your arm is back, my brain says. Maybe it is, I reply. So I walk down to the bullpen and starts to warm up. All my teammates, they stop playing and come over to watch. It's coming around, they said, like they seen a miracle. 3 days later, Mr. Wilkinson puts me in for 2 innings. I strikes out all 6 batters. That was like my second childhood. After pitching nonstop for 20 years, there's resting for 7 months that allowed my arm to heal. Well, as you can imagine, my comeback sparked a lot of interest, and not just with colored folks. Major leaguers saw a great opportunity to make some extra cash during the Depression years by conducting barnstorming tours, pitting colored players against white. Oh, we were only too happy to oblige. If we couldn't play in the major leagues, the next best thing was for us to play against their players and win. Out of 400 or so barnstorming games, Negro Leaguers won 300. I was beginning to understand why they might not want us in their league after all. Now, I liked playing against the Negro League teams, but I loved barnstorming. Major Leaguers, they were just trying to make a payday. But colored players, we had some real proof that we were as good, that we were better than the players in a league that wouldn't allow us in. Dizzy Dean, the great St. Louis pitcher, he said that his fastball looked like a slow ball compared to the bullets I was throwing. He said, that Satchel Paige is the best pitcher I ever seen, and I've been looking in the mirror my whole life. Along with Dizzy, some of the best white ball players in the country did these barnstorming tours. Stan Musial, Jimmy Fox, and the great Joe DiMaggio. They all learned we weren't some minor league. We were their equals, including in this sport. Now, somebody once said to Buck O'Neill, now it's a shame that Paige never got the chance to pitch to the best hitters every day. Oh, Buck, he looks this fellow right in the eye and says, who says he didn't? Yeah, that's right, Buck. Best hitter, though, was my friend and competitor, Josh Gibson. Josh was built like the boxer Joe Louis, and he could hit like him, too, only with a bat. If we were allowed in the major leagues, every team would have wanted Josh. They called him the Black Babe Ruth. We thought Babe ought to be nicknamed the White Josh Gibson. When the Pittsburgh Pirates asked permission to sign Josh, the baseball commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, he said, colored players have their own league. Let them stay in their league. And after that, Josh started drinking more and wrecking that great body of his. He's living a wild life and getting into drugs and things. He had a stroke at 35 and died just 3 months before the Dodgers signed Jackie Robinson. To me, Josh was a Superman. I thought nothing could ever beat him. But I believe what killed him more than anything was that he never got the chance to play in the major leagues. So around this time, I started saying to myself, hey, Satchel, don't you go looking at the big leagues no more. They ain't for you. But guess what? Mr. Bill Beck of the Cleveland Indians, he calls me one day and says, Satchel, I'm in the middle of a pennant race and I need pitching. So suddenly, I was the oldest rookie in the history of the major leagues. That's right. Satchel Paige, the first colored pitcher in the American leagues. I made my major league debut in front of the largest baseball crowd ever, over 78,000 fans. Old Satch can still pack the stands, and I aim to give all 78,000 a reason to cheer, just like I always did. The pitcher's mound is still 60 feet, 6 inches from home plate, but of course, this ain't just another game. Satchel Paige is pitching. position on the big stage. I waited a long time for this. I won my first game and ended the season with 6 wins and only 1 loss and helped the Indians make the World Series. They tried to name me Rookie of the Year. Got first year, but I declined that offer. But after 5 years in the majors, I retired to go back to my barnstorming ways. That is all except for one game with the Kansas City Athletics in 1965. Well, by this time, I was 60-something. Well, maybe that is important because I retired 9 of the 10 batters I faced that day. I think I was just proving that we don't stop playing because we get old. We get old because we stop playing. Some of you will recognize this room. If you've been to Cooperstown, New York, there's a lot of important folks on the walls here. When Ted Williams was inducted in 1966, he called for the Negro Leaguers to be put into the hall. Now that kind of endorsement got the attention of the selection committee. And out of hundreds of names, 4 of us were selected for possible future induction. But as always, there was still another hurdle for Satch to clear. It seems my single appearance with Kansas City the year before, that forced a delay in my induction until 1971 because I was considered an active player even though I was almost 100 years old. But this gave the major leagues plenty of time to properly prepare for me, and they needed it because the original plan was for Satch to go in the back door into a special wing for Negro Leaguers. Man! They just didn't want to make it easy for old Satch. Seems like every time I get to the top, there's another reason to keep me down. Baseball wanted to take me from being a second-class citizen and turn me into a second-class immoral. But the commissioner, he made the right decision when he put my bust in the same room with baseball greats. Ruth, Matheson, DiMaggio, and of course, Jackie Robinson. I was finally inducted on February 9th, 1971. Now that's Jackie's bust over there. A lot of people bring their kids to see him. I don't mind. He was a hero. He was what you call a good role model. I never ran for that office. You know, Buck O'Neill used to say that people don't realize that we got the ball rolling on integration in our whole society, not just baseball. There's this one time when Buck and I were in Charleston, South Carolina, deep in the heart of Dixie. I grabbed Buck and took him over to Drum Island. That's where they used to auction off the slaves. Thousands and thousands of our ancestors brought over here from Africa in chains, herded like animals and sold like dry goods. There's a little plaque there, of course, saying what had happened. We stood there for a good long while, not saying a word. And finally I says, you know what, Buck? He says, what, Satch? He says, it seems like I've been here before. He says, me too. I can see now, they made no mistake in signing Robinson. He was able to go through hell and hold his tongue. I'd have been a disaster at that. Yeah, they made no mistake in signing Jackie. He took the pressure and the abuse. He took the next steps on the journey we all started. What it all comes down to is that we did what we loved to do and what we was good at. We paved the way for generations of proud black men to play in the major leagues without even a second glance. How about that, Josh? Jackie's the first guy in, and I was the oldest. It's not that important. What is important is that we got in at all. You know, outside the Hall of Fame building, there's this big old statue of me in the middle of my pitching motion. If you look at it closely, you just might see me decide to do one last triple windup. I'd be kicking my leg way up in the air and saying, look out, Josh, here it comes. And I'd uncork one final pitch from Satchel Paige.